Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline, isn't here today, but will be joining us again soon. And instead of Mom, we just have me and our guest, Heather Mateus Sappenfield, and I hope I pronounced that right.
Yeah, that's good.
Pretty close. Okay. So Heather's writing explores the adventures that fill life, often in the Rocky Mountain landscape that has been her lifelong home. She has won many accolades for her fiction, including the Arthur Edelstein Prize and 3 Pushcart Prize nominations. She's been recognized as a finalist for the Flannery O'Connor Award, the Kraken Prize, and the Colorado Book Awards. Lyrics for Rock Stars is her first short story collection. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Heather.
Hello, Monica. I'm so glad to be here. And I'm sorry I can't talk with Caroline as well. I really enjoy listening to both of you on the show, and I think it's so beautiful that you do this together.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. In fact, I probably wouldn't have done this show at all if it weren't for her. When we first started in 2006, and we were invited to start a show on a local radio station that was just starting up, which is unfortunately no longer operating, but we're now on a couple of other stations and, of course, on the web. But my mom had been in radio for many years and had done basically since I was in high school, she had done various different times when she had radio shows.
Wow.
And at that point, she was getting older. My stepdad had just died, and I wanted something where I could connect with her every week and something that we could do together. And so that was 2006. So October of 2006. So we're going on 14 years.
Well, and especially during COVID, too. What a great thing to have.
Yeah.
Yep.
And she turned 85 this summer.
That's fantastic. So,
and still going strong.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm very happy about that. So, Heather, you've lived in the Western United States your whole life, sounds like.
Yes. Colorado my whole life.
Ah.
And I grew up around the Front Range of Colorado. I moved a lot, bounced all over the Front Range, which is basically the Front Range in Colorado. We call the Front Range is that whole area leading to the Rocky Mountains from the eastern side of the United States. And then we call the Western Slope the other side of the Rockies. California, just for those folks who, I might use some terminology you don't know. And I grew up down there, but I have lived now in the Vail Valley for, 30 years now. It's hard to admit that and believe it. But I've been up here in the mountains for a long time.
Are you a skier?
Oh, yes. Yeah. In fact, I was a ski instructor for Vail Resorts for years.
So I have to ask, you have a story in here about a ski instructor.
Yes.
Is that based on something that actually happened?
Well, I would say it's sort of a conglomerate of many things. the way the story ends, not necessarily. But I was really well known for being just amazing with women who had fear.
Mm.
And it was just so joyous to and regular people, men and women, but especially women. It was so joyous to get them to the point where they were confident and having a great time. And I just got to thinking at one point about, but you were kind of cocky about that. What if the tables were turned? And so that definitely comes into play. And all you read about there is teaching of how, I taught beginners.
Right. So what you describe in there where the ski instructor is sort of sharing her own fear, have you ever had something like that?
Yes. That part where the ski instructor does have that fear of heights, that's me for sure, too.
Ah.
And if I hadn't grown up going up chairlifts, I would have much more fear than I do. And when she talks about a coat over her head, you know, when she gets close to the top of a peak. That actually happened to me at Long's Peak. There's this, one of our famous 14ers in our state. And we were like literally 100 yards from the top. And to get to the top of that mountain, you have to cross this, it's kind of a cliff face that's about a sidewalk wide. With like a 1,000-foot drop on the side, and then you get up on top of the peak, and it's like a big football field, or so I've heard, of just rocks. But I got out about 50 yards. I was like, and at that point, I'd been hiking for like 11 hours to get to that point. And I got out a few feet onto it, and just completely, I lost it. You know, I mean, it's not something you can reason with, that fear of heights. And so literally my friends had to put a coat over my head and steer me away. And they left me with a bag of M&Ms.
You know, I have a bit of a fear of heights too. And what it is that if I get too close to the edge of something, I'm afraid I'm going to jump off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Yes.
Have you ever been to the Cliffs of Moher on the coast of Ireland?
I wish.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And of course, it's this cliff that falls into the ocean. And there's a fence that you're not supposed to go down, like really on the cliff, but people do it all the time. And I was there with my kids many years ago, and they were in their early 20s, early to mid 20s. And so they both wanted, or my son wanted to go climb out on the cliff. And if you can go across kind of a, to this tower across the way and photograph onto the cliff. And so he wanted me to go do that and take a picture of him out on this cliff. It's quite a distance, so it's kind of hard to tell who's there. But I went and did that. Well, I didn't realize that my daughter, who had stayed back with him, also decided she would go out on this cliff. And you could only go one at a time because you have to go around this outcropping. Uh-huh. And it's this narrow ledge, you know, and you have to go kind of hug the rock to get out over it, to get over to this other side. And I didn't get a picture of her because I didn't know she was going to do it. And she was so disappointed, but she wasn't willing to do it again because the wind was blowing really strong too. And I was terrified just watching.
It sounds beautiful and like something I'd like to watch from.
Yeah, from a distance. Yeah.
And, you know, in all honesty, it makes me a little more proud when I do some of these things that I do, because I do have to overcome that fear. And you probably know about that, Monica, where you're like, yeah, okay, I'm going to not freak out here.
Right. Yeah. So, Heather, how long have you been writing?
I have been writing my whole life. From the time I was a little girl, I knew I would live in the mountains and be a writer. I just knew it. And, you know, my life has taken a circuitous route and there's been a lot of surprises. And yet here I am doing this. So I've always been writing stories, always. Seriously, though, like actually, you know, I think that taking that step saying, okay, I'm going to seriously try to be a writer is kind of scary, really. For me, it was because here again, we're talking about fear, but, no, because there's the chance, if you really want to go for it, that you might fail. You might not live up to what your dreams are and accomplish that. But when I really, really, I had been a freelance journalist for a while and had lots of things published that way. But I really wanted to be a fiction writer. And when my daughter was about a year old, I was teaching high school English. And she started talking with the Australian accent of her daycare lady. And I love Australian accents, but that was a paradigm shift for me. And I decided, okay, I'm going to stay home with my daughter. And so I resigned from my position and decided to really pursue writing fiction. And so, you know, right as she was taking her first steps, I was as well as a writer. So, that would be mark the time, and that would be about 21 years ago that I really decided to pursue this seriously.
And of course, like you said, there's the fear of not fulfilling your dreams, but there's also the fear of fulfilling your dreams.
Yes. Agreed. That as well.
Yeah. So So your daughter grew up having a mom who was a writer.
Yes, she did.
How did she like that? Was she like, this is so cool, you know, here's my mom writes books and I love books and this is just the coolest thing ever? Or was it, okay, mom's locked in a room again, not paying any attention?
Well, in her younger years, you know, I would write when she would take a nap and I'd settle in for that, you know, and then once she started school, I was able to write during the day. But, you know, this writer's life, you know, we're kind of weird writers, you know, we get very involved in a book and we're focused on that a lot. So yes, on weekends, sometimes I would be writing, or into the evening or something like that. So, but I think that she loves books. In fact, she just had to come home. She's at college now at Johns Hopkins and she had to come home for an emergency tonsillectomy. It wasn't COVID, but during COVID, it was scary. So she came back here and had her tonsils out. And then just as she was getting healed, I managed a picture, and she called it a personality pic. It cracked her up. She's literally brushing her teeth, holding a book and reading in the bathroom. And she's so engrossed in the book that she doesn't even notice I'm taking the picture. So I said, way to make your mom proud. You know, like books have just been a major part of our life. The Bible in our house was the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And so I think she just grew up and it was a natural thing for her to have a writer as a mom.
And does she want to be a writer?
She is a fantastic writer, a better writer than I am, I think. But she's also seen how poor writers are. So I'm not sure if she wants to head down that road or not. And also, it's so much work. So I think she's trying to decide. She's a dual major, in cognitive science and English. And my husband is a science teacher. So it was like, way to make both your parents proud, honey.
Oh, that's so cool. And of course, Johns Hopkins is a wonderful school and it's one of the best sources for information about what's going on with COVID.
Exactly. They've been handling it beautifully.
Yeah, I bet. How did they do the, bring students back? What was their protocol?
Well, right up until just before school started, they were going to have all the freshmen there living on campus, but in singles. And then sophomores were going to be spread out around the campus more in dorms, or they might have been in houses as well. She's a senior now, my daughter, so she's off campus. And they were going to be doing both live and virtual classes. And then they took a look at the statistics and the facts and decided that it just wasn't right. And they decided to go purely virtual. And part of that was because they didn't want to impact Baltimore, all those students coming in as well, you know? So I think that's something universities have to look at as well is, you know, how are we impacting the surrounding community? Those are jobs, but at the same time, are we bringing in more cases? So I think it was both of those things. And again, this is just my position as someone who's read a few parent videos. I think they've handled it really beautifully. So
very good. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Heather Mateus Sappenfield, author of Lyrics for Rock Stars. Now, this is your first short story collection.
Yes.
How over what time period were these stories written?
Well, I started writing these stories, basically that first story in the collection, Coloring Beyond the Lines, I wrote shortly after I decided to stay home with my daughter. So there's some perspective for you, right? And I wrote that, and, you know, my other girlfriend neighbors who were staying home were reading it for me. They were my readers at that point. And I also wrote a couple of novels that were pretty terrible and some children's books, and I had some really near misses with editors at magazines, where I actually revised stories and they still didn't take them. And a few years into it, I decided, wow, you know, I think I need to work on my craft. And I enrolled in the MFA program at Pacific University. And I would say an MFA isn't necessarily for everyone, but it changed my career and my life and for the better. So that really was a threshold for me that helped me get, you know, being a teacher, sometimes I'm not, this isn't probably true of everybody, but sometimes you look at stories from a different perspective, from the perspective of the person unraveling them, so to speak, or puzzling them out. Whereas as a writer, you know, it's the other end. You're putting everything in. You get to unlearn a lot of those things. They were holding me back a bit in my writing that I had been doing as a teacher. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. I had to unlearn that and some other bad habits, and boy, it was really great. So, that story, I wrote it first, and then during the program, you know, short stories are one of the best vehicles for learning craft. You know, they're compact, they're concise. You've got a beginning, a middle, an end. You've got character development, and it's all there. So I wrote 7 of the stories while I was there at the program. And then a few months before graduating, Real Cowboy appeared in Shenandoah. And then Empty Feast was a runner-up for the Fiction Prize at Meridian. And then Indian Prayer won the Danahy Fiction Prize. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm a writer. I felt like I was on a roll. But can I tell you, I was so wrong. Writing, you know, this writing never stops teaching us. And so those were things that came along the way, but I still had so much to learn post MFA about myself as a writer, my own voice, where stories need to go, how to be patient and figure out what a story really wants to be about, not what my ambition wants it to be. So those things were part of my lesson. I still feel every time I start a new story, I'm going to learn all new things.
Wow. So at this point, you've had some novels published?
Yes. I've published 2 young adult novels, one in 2015 and one in 2016. And they're literary young adult crossover, 14 and up. And it's kind of interesting, the writing business, right, though, because I became known as a young adult novelist sort of out there. But I had all these short stories that I'd published before. So it was sort of an interesting place to be in. But, you know, I'm not complaining. Yeah. And then so these stories I've been writing all the way along as well. And then they've come along. Yeah.
And what was the impetus for putting them into a collection?
Well, I wanted them to come into the world on their own as a group. But, you know, it's funny. After I finished my MFA, I kept writing stories. And I realized at one point, hey, I've got enough stories for a collection here. Yeah, congratulations. And so I actually entered them in, 5 or 6 contests. And the collection was a finalist literally in every contest. But I must be missing something, though, for it to continue to be a finalist but not to win. So I put it in the drawer. And I'm going to backtrack a little bit. There's this marvelous quotation from Carlos Ruiz Zafón, which I find very true, which is, books are mirrors. You only see in them what you have inside you. And so, backtracking again, when I was at the MFA program, I had a semester with Pete Fromm, and I don't know if you know him, but he is a fabulous Western writer, and he was also the toughest editor I'd ever had. And he kept saying to me in these stories, you're leaving the scene too early. You need to stay with the characters. You have to write out the scene. And I was like, I can't. Oh, my gosh, this is hard. No, you know, it's just forcing yourself to stay. And I literally had to go to therapy to get myself to be able to stay in the scenes, right?
Whoa. And,
exactly. And so through that process, I mean, he helped me. I mean, this writing, he helped me so much, not only with my writing, but I also was getting over some things in my life, right? Because you're writing around the things in your life often in a story. So I literally was able then to stay with the scene with that. And then a few years ago, I discovered yoga, and I, through that, was able to also kind of bring further into my physical being a lot of those things I'd worked on in therapy. And actually, the yoga was kind of the sealing of all of those things to where I mean, it purified a lot of my writing, how I was placing words on the page even, and how my language was and the things I was writing around. And I pulled the collection back out of the drawer, and all of a sudden, and I was ready to see how the stories all fit together. I hadn't been there before, emotionally and maturistically and all of that. And so suddenly it was apparent that they needed to be divided into these two sections, Songs of Innocence and Songs of Wisdom, and that those would play off of each other literally, but also ironically and symbolically and universally. And yeah, so that's when I really knew and understood the collection and how it was speaking.
So you didn't have to rewrite the stories.
Well, then I also was writing way better. So I went in and just polished the stories a bit and tweaked them to fit more within that thematic level. You know, every story in the collection, I hope every sentence in the collection is working on three levels. It's working on, one, advancing the story itself, two, advancing the messages of that story, and three, advancing the collection overall and its themes. And so once I was able to see how all that was working together, then I was able to go back through the entire collection and then rework it. And then after I did that, I entered it in a couple of contests. And, you know, ironically, too, I entered it in contests that seemed to fit the collection instead of my ideals of success.
Ah.
And it was a finalist in the final running for two. And then I heard that it had won the V-Press LC Book Compilation Prize or Compilation Book Prize. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. And it has been such a great journey. V-Press has been fantastic.
And tell us a little bit about V-Press.
Well, it's a small press, fairly new, started by women. And I selected them because there's a lot of women's themes in this collection and how women have moved through history. And they seemed a good fit. The managing editor and director, Tori Amory Dale, I just admire her so much, just starting this press and moving forward. And she's been great, but she is also a survivor of domestic abuse to the point where there was a film made about her. And so it just felt like the right collection with the right publisher. And it certainly has proven true.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great kind of Cinderella story for this collection.
Yeah. Definitely is.
Now, I notice, okay, so the two sections that you mentioned are the tale, Songs of Innocence and Songs of Wisdom. And mm-hmm. the Songs of Innocence are mostly or maybe all from a child's perspective, a child's point of view.
Yeah, childs and teens.
And the others are from adult point of view. Now, one thing I noticed that these children all mostly live in pretty dysfunctional families.
Yes.
But it sounds like you have a pretty functional family there. So where are you drawing this from, and why are you drawn to this kind of story?
Well, I think my family, my immediate family, my husband, my daughter, myself, you know, I've been with my husband for a long time and we're very happy. But I had a wild childhood and I had a writer's childhood. And I don't really want to go into a lot more than that because I think I don't want to make things hard for anybody.
Mm.
But some of those themes in there are from my childhood. And I literally, in therapy, have learned that, like, I literally have almost no memories of my childhood, but I do have facts and things that happened and bold senses of what happened, like what it felt like, but literally, like, almost no memories. And so it's a beautiful place to write from. I remember being in a class with my MFA with Jack Driscoll, who was talking about, he was trying to write a story based upon something he witnessed as a child. And he remembered like every last detail. And he was just too close to the details of the story. The story wasn't working. And then finally he realized he just needed a few touch points. And then he wrote into the feeling and the truth with a capital T of what happened in the story. And right. For me,
if you're tied to trying to really just sort of lay out the events that happened, you may not be able to get to that truth.
Exactly. So, what I just wrote, you know, I would remember some of the things. And again, who says like memoir, like memory, whatever, what really happened? We all remember things differently according to the stories we want to make about ourselves in our own lives too, right?
Oh, for sure.
I had certain things that had happened that I knew in my life. I had a vague sense of it. I had a feeling of what it was like. And so I just, from there, it's all fiction. Like, you know, like some things happen and it, but it's all made up. But the feeling of it is there. And that's what I would write toward.
You know, it's interesting. I have a younger brother. I have a number of siblings, but I have a younger brother who claims to have almost no memories of his childhood before a certain age. Mm-hmm. And that age is when I left home. I was quite a bit older, and I took care of him a lot when he was little, because my mom was working after school, so he was my responsibility. It was, you know, pretty sudden, and I really never came home again. And so my attention completely, it was not on my little brother at all. And I always wondered if that might have been why he blocked out that.
We're such interesting creatures, aren't we?
Yeah. You know, at that age, at 18, you know, sure, I wasn't thinking about the impact of my decisions and my actions on my, you know, 9-year-old brother.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Heather Matea Sappenfield, author of Lyrics for Rock Stars. Heather, why don't you read, do we have time, do you think, to read a whole story or part of a story?
Well, I have the beginning of Heavenly Father. I thought I might read to you.
Okay.
About 10 minutes.
That sounds great.
Okay. And again, this is a story that, again, has like, I knew that this thing happened to my mother. She was blind in one eye, but I didn't know any other details about it. And she was the daughter of a minister. So there, you'll see how my process works here, sort of. Right? It's like totally.
Yes, yeah.
Wow, could that be potent? So here starts Heavenly Father. "Turn your test papers over, please," Miss Manning said at 11:55. Our teacher strolled through the three rows, collecting them, and set the stack on her desk. She glanced at the clock, then at Teddy's blank test, which I could see on the stack's top, then at him, slouching in the back with his legs taking over the aisle. She didn't see the spitball he'd shot into Angeline's golden curls, or how afterward Angeline had peered over her shoulder at him, mouthing, "Satan." At noon, Miss Manning said, "You may go to lunch." Angeline and I raced to our cubbies, grabbed our Roy Rogers lunch boxes, and ran to the metal bars. We tossed our lunches in the gravel, waiting to eat our bologna sandwiches till later so we wouldn't puke. The bars were actually one continuous bar that ran through a fat post in the middle, supported by two posts on the outsides. It was meant for pull-ups, but we'd scramble to the top, one leg over that bar. We'd hold on with both hands and spin. I'd shut my eyes to keep from getting dizzy and loved falling forward, my long brown hair whipping behind. Loved how gravity tugged my face just as I kicked my back leg to snap skyward. Loved how all the recess voices smashed into one garble. Spinning stretched the world like taffy, and I couldn't get enough. 19. I reached the top and arced down again. 20. I stopped and balanced. Teddy leaned against a humongous cottonwood on the playground's fringe. Most days, the way he stood reminded me of the rifles Dad kept in a glass case by the TV. Still, I couldn't get enough of his cleft chin and wavy black hair. He'd been picking on Angeline since school's first minute. "The Lord will protect me," she'd say, but I wasn't so sure. Now Teddy seemed cocked and ready, and he held up his fist and talked to it. "You're an ace, Hildy. How'd you do that?" Angeline said. She spun forward, her hair flashing in the sun. She got to 10 and wobbled to a stop. "I get so dizzy." I glanced at the sixth grade boys who kept an eye on pretty Angeline. It felt good to have her envy me for a change. "Teddy's mad." I nodded in his direction. "The Lord will protect me," she spun. Our school had 61 kids, and I studied the rest of them to keep my eyes from Teddy. The first graders climbed on the slide like always. Second grade was on the swings. Third grade was at the blacktop playing hopscotch or four square. The fourth grade girls squealed as the boys chased them in freeze tag. The fifth grade boys played basketball. The sixth graders hung out against the school's wall and avoided Teddy. We spun. It's what the fifth grade girls did, and we were the only ones, so we never had to share. I spun again till my arm shook. When I stopped, Teddy was gone. I scanned the playground. Our school perched on a rise, and from up on the bars, I could see our church's brick steeple, the water tower that said Zuckerman, the sugar plant's white silo with C and H in big blue letters on its side, then the beet fields reaching for miles. A train approached, a distant clunk, 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 that stirred with the recess voices. A tractor rolled along the straight line of our one road through town. The train neared an intersection with an empty dirt road and blew its horn. "Ooh, bung, 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 bung," Angeline harmonized with the train. "Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream," I joined him. "Make him the cutest that I've ever seen." Our lungs stretched with song. The metal in my palms and the crook of my knee was blood warm. We sang Shaboom. I had Angeline all to myself up there, and it felt like heaven. Until I remembered it was Monday. "Are you going fishing today?" "Uh-huh," she said. On Monday afternoons in spring and fall, Angeline's father took her to the reservoir outside town. She would rush home from school, and I'd hustle to keep up, wishing she'd invite me. From my bedroom window, I'd watch them load up their Buick. "Daddy, did you get the worms?" Angeline would say, or, "Should I get the folding chairs, Daddy?" At church, while Angeline would gaze at her father in the pulpit, Teddy would gaze at her in the front row. I longed for a front row seat with the Lord. Before I knew it, I'd said, "Can I come?" "No, it's special time with Daddy." The way Angeline's voice went up on Daddy made me say, "You mean your dad?" The rest of us had started calling our father's dad a while ago. Red scorched up her neck. "You're just jealous," she sniffed and turned away. I couldn't move. I wanted to slug her. "Jealous? You think you're so great?" She spun and stopped, breathless. "It's not my fault your father only works at the plant and drinks beer and watches TV. I can't help that I'm special. I can't help if I have the best father in the world." She tossed her curls and turned away again. I turned away, too. Angeline gasped. I thought she was crying, maybe ready to apologize. Instead, Teddy stood below, and everything slowed in my mind. The playground hushed. The sixth grade boys stepped away from the wall. Miss Manning ran toward us from the picnic table on the playground's far side where the rest of the teachers ate. "You think you're Coolsville because your daddy is the minister," Teddy said, low and deadly. His hand whipped out to the side and a dark blur shot into Angeline's eye, then dropped to the gravel. Angeline slumped forward and plummeted, screaming, from the bar. Miss Manning hovered over her seconds later. Principal Berger grabbed Teddy's arms from behind, wrestling him toward the school, but Teddy wheeled free and punched the man's soft middle. Principal Berger doubled over. Teddy looked at Angeline, sagging like he might reach out to her, like he longed to pull her into his arms. I understood exactly how he felt. He turned and ran. Kids crowded around Angeline. Principal Berger, still holding his middle, nudged his way through. She covered her eye and wailed as he picked her up and carried her toward the school. Miss Manning walked beside them, and with each of Principal Berger's steps, Angeline's saddle shoes swang out, kicking her, but she didn't seem to notice. They disappeared inside with Angeline's cries echoing down the hall and out the propped open door. Every face turned to me. I slid back my leg, balanced on my hips, and dropped to the ground, never more thankful to be wearing shorts under my skirt. I picked up my lunchbox, then Angeline's, and walked toward the school, stiff from all those eyes on my back. In the nurse's office, Angeline curled on the cot, holding a white towel, lumpy with ice, against her eye. She wailed so loudly the ground seemed to tilt. Miss Manning sat at her feet, patting her leg. When she saw me standing in the doorway, she stood and offered me the seat next to Angeline, but I shook my head. I set our lunchboxes against the wall. Reverend Gottschalk entered the room all stately. "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy," Angeline cried. He knelt down in front of her. "Shh, let's see. It hurts. Shh." He peeled back the towel and her whole eye flared red, but it did not bleed. The adults looked at each other. "Let's get you to Doc Barnes." He scooped her up. As he stepped sideways to fit through the door, Angeline rested her head against his chest. I stepped out of the way so they could pass, hoping she'd look at me, but her uncovered eye stayed glued on her dad. Doc Barnes had brought both Angeline and me into the world at Mercy Hospital, along with my sister, Freda, who was 18, and my brother, Charlie, who was 16. Doc attended our church, but since his wife died, he always sat in the back near the door. His hair and eyes and smile looked exactly like a doctor should, and when I was sick and visited his office, just laying eyes on him made me feel better. I imagined Doc Barnes peeling that white towel from Angeline's blood, eyes smiling and saying, "I have just the thing." Principal Berger hurried ahead to the school's front door. I trailed behind, praying Angeline would reach for me, beg me to come along. Principal Berger opened the Buick's door, and Reverend Gottschalk set her in the passenger seat. The door groaned as Principal Berger closed it. "I'm mighty sorry this happened, Reverend. We've phoned the sheriff. We'll see that this boy is brought to justice." "You say it was Teddy Bascom?" Reverend Gottschalk opened the driver's side door, then paused and fixed our principal with a scolding stare. "That boy's family is part of our congregation," he said. "You'll do no such thing." My ears burned from his tone. Principal Berger's face reddened, and he looked at the ground. Angeline slumped in her seat.
And that was Heather Sappenfield reading from Heavenly Father, which is one of the stories in Lyrics for Rock Stars. Mm-hmm. Now, Heather, some of the stories are set in the distant past. How did these stories come to be, and how do they fit in with the others, which are more modern?
Well, you know, I love my state and I love Colorado and the West, but I'm also so fascinated by its past. You know, if you go to Rome or to Lisbon or even Boston or Baltimore, you know, the past is pretty evident. There's a lot of physical signs of it. But out here in the West, we have so much open land, and our indigenous peoples had a much more different relationship with the land. You know, we have Mesa Verde and maybe petroglyphs, but they're mysterious. There wasn't really any writing about them. And it wasn't until, you know, we had the whites moving into this area that we started to have buildings, and they, you know, started changing the shape of the land and things like that. And yet the past is so evident here. And we move through it. I believe there's kind of a residual energies and things that we experience in certain places when we move through those. As an example, here in Vail, we have our back bowls, right? And so Vail's famous for them. It's on the back side of the main mountain. and they are wide open, mostly treeless bowls, and there's seven of them. They go for miles. And what happened with those, how they were formed, was years ago, back in 1879, 1880, the Utes were in their final days of, it was the Utes must go, and they were being forced out of this area. And it was an incredible drought year. And a fire started, not unlike how we've had fires here, you know, just the smallest thing could start a fire. The Utes, the whites blamed the Utes to further foment sentiment against them. But this whole region just burned in a huge fire. And it's what's given Vail the aspen glades and that wide open bowls that they're famous for. And so people can literally come here and visit and ski down through the back bowls and ski past like these charred trunks of these ancient huge pines that stand like monoliths. And they don't even realize that history, or maybe they'll stand in the lift line where there was probably teepees and, you know, where the Utes had their summer villages. And so that fascinates me. In fact, to the point where like my second young adult novel, I wrote about that, and the girl in it time travels back to when the Utes were being starved out and forced out. And then she comes back to the future and she's going into the ski lodge where someone's handing her a tissue and she's going to go buy a brownie. So just those layers that are there that we interact with, even, you know, moving along from that time period, that just fascinates me.
Now, most of your stories are written from a female point of view. Are they all?
No. There's Clan is a male point of view. Go is a male point of view. The final story is a male point of view. And that story is particularly important to me as well.
Yes. Let's talk about that. The oldest living man in America.
Yeah.
So, what was the motivation, the spark for this story?
So, this, let's see. So, my grandfather was literally the oldest living man in America. And
He was
111 years old. Before he passed away. So it was really kind of a cool thing. But that said, he is not this man. I think it all kind of came to a head because, that I knew that about him, but then it was also the anniversary of the Apollo 11, first steps on the moon. At the same time, I heard this incredible story about a man from the Middle East who had gone away to war and come back, and I don't want to ruin the story, but that also was something that played into that. And I thought, wow, you know, the amazing things that one person has seen over the course of a lifetime like that, how amazing to be sitting there watching a man walk on the moon when you could have experienced the Civil War as well. And so that's the impetus for that story. But at the same time, I think there's a lot about women in this story and the women narrators, because I am a woman, and I'm also fascinated by how women have had to move through history. But this final story here is a man looking back at how he's treated a woman. And for me, I hope it operates almost as a hinge of almost forgiveness that changes how all the earlier stories work.
Wow. There's a woman in the story, mm-hmm. who gets shushed every time she speaks.
Yes.
So what's that all about?
Well, I hope this story works on some sort of a metaphorical level about women. How we worry for the care, you know, the softer side. How will he ever get home? How are the boys going to survive that? And no, because we need to move forward. We need to drive forward. We need to march forward. It's ambition, you know, and fighting and wars. But then there's a softer spot, you know, well, wait a minute, what about the human aspects? What are the costs of that? You know, so that's what it's supposed to be.
Ah, very good. Very good. When you first started writing fiction,
yeah,
you said it took you a while to really learn the craft.
Yes.
And then you started getting stories placed in magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And at what point were you, did you struggle to get your first book published, or did that come more easily?
Oh, wow. So the first young adult novel that came out in 2015, that came really easily, actually. I had written that manuscript before I started the MFA after teaching, and it dealt with teen suicide. And I had lost a couple of students while I was teaching. And I think that was one of my obsessions at that point was, you know, if we could, I just could have made them stick around.
Mm.
You know, if they just could have gotten beyond that point, how would they have felt? If they could have seen how sad everyone was, how hurt we all were, and we wanted them back and we loved them. So I had written that before, but it was not in good shape. So after post-MFA, I revised it and sent it off and had good luck getting an agent, and she sold it, and it was just pretty quick. And those two novels happened in quick succession. And the second novel came out in 2016. And the thing was, a little bit about me as a writer. So in genre, because I write across all genres is what is the truth. I consider myself an everything writer. And I believe that genre is useful, but that we kind of get stuck in it. I believe we actually are types of writers and types of readers. And the type of writer I am is someone who likes really well-crafted written narrative that has literary tendencies. And I love those kinds of books, whether they're young adult, mystery, romance, middle grade. My favorite books cross all those different genres. Maybe I'm in the mood for that on a particular night, but I like to have that type of book within that genre. Does that make sense?
Okay.
And so I write, no matter whatever I'm writing, I will have it'll be well, I'll work on hard on the craft and it will have literary tendencies. And so, for example, those two YA books came out, but I still was writing the short stories. And then, now I have a middle grade book as well that was recently the finalist for the Kraken Prize that will be coming out in spring of 2022. And so across all of those places, I'm that type of a writer, and you can go to one of my books and know that in a middle grade book, you're going to have a more literary experience. So where I'm going with that, I lost track of that for a while though, and I tried to write specifically for genre and it didn't work for me. My writing kind of fell apart. I was trying to produce these young adult books and I just couldn't do it. And so what I learned that what I needed to do was actually write the story that arrived in the way that it needed to be arrived or needed to be written. So in my case, I have mild dyslexia and stories tend to arrive pretty fully formed, escorted by the narrator. And I listened to your talk with Ruta Sepetys. Is that how you
mm-hmm.
say it? I love books, right?
Right, right.
Kind of opposite places. Like she wants to write about a time in history. I actually have a narrator arrive, and then I wait to see what the narrator's story needs to be, and then I get the details historically that help the story.
Ah.
So the whole story arrives there, and so the narrator in my head is what determines what genre the story is going to be, where it's going to be, and how it's going to be written. So based upon that. So, for instance, if the narrator with his middle grade book that's coming out, I could tell that narrator, she's an 11-year-old girl, and that story needed to be told from that perspective. And so then once I know that, then I change how I craft the story to fit that reader's needs. So middle grade readers, boy, you know, I think their books are just as complex and just as full of meaning. In fact, they're hungry to learn about the world. And sometimes I think adults, we can be kind of conditioned into the ways that we go head into things and learn about the world, right?
Right.
So what I will do then is, if it's a middle grade book, then I will craft it thus so that the inferential moments are more direct and clearer. The sentence structures aren't as complex. You know, I'll have simple sentences or compound sentences, but and no huge, long, glowing passages of description, you know, things like that, because kids aren't interested in that and they're not ready for that. Another thing that helps me determine which genre it's going to be is if it wants to be right in the moment and there's no nostalgia and there's no looking back, that's going to be middle grade or young adult.
Interesting.
But if it's looking back with nostalgia and reflecting on an experience, then I have an adult book.
Interesting. Now, does it make it harder, more difficult to build a career when you're skipping around in genres than it might be if you were in a single one?
I would think absolutely, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it's kind of a crazy thing I'm doing. And the thing, I tried to mold myself into just being a young adult writer, and it didn't work for me. It's not to say I'm not going to write another young adult novel at some point, but my latest novel that I just finished is an adult literary humorous novel. And that's idling until I've finished releasing this story collection. But yeah.
And that's quite a departure.
Yes. Yeah, right? And that's the story that needs to happen. So I don't know. I am enjoying the process of publishing these books and bringing them into the world and trying to let go of ambition, in all honesty, and being true to the craft.
Now, do you have a specific writing routine?
Yes. So most mornings I am up late as 6 o'clock, and I come up and I work until 10 or 11 o'clock, and then I try to get outside, and then I'll come back in, and it depends on where I am in a story or what needs to happen. Then I'll tend to other editing kinds of things into the mid afternoon. But I have to be careful. I can write myself completely out. You know, I have to be careful to end at good places and not write too much.
Ah, so you have a good place to start from the next day.
Exactly. And so that I don't fatigue my mind and that I'm still fresh. You know, our brains are muscles. You know, it's kind of like running or walking too far or something. Yeah.
I've heard of writers that actually will stop in the middle of a sentence, so it's easy to start the next day.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And if being disciplined, I do that, but a lot of times I'm a bit of an addict and I keep going.
Well, that's the other thing. If you're on a roll, if you're really into it, it's very hard to stop because you're afraid you might lose it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you say that these stories, you have the character, the narrator that comes in the head who wants to tell this story. Do you always know how the story is going to end up?
The story arrives pretty fully formed. The surprises of story usually end up in the details of how things work themselves out. Every once in a while, the ending of a story may change, but it's pretty rare. It's pretty fully formed. Yeah.
Wow. So you're just sort of capturing it.
Yeah, in a way. Yes. Writing through it and capturing it. You know, my head is a crowded place. I think there's like 6 or 7 books up there right now. So.
Oh my gosh. And are they all over the map in terms of time setting
Yes. Yeah. Yep. They are. Yeah,
but are they all set in Colorado?
You know, there is, I'm not sure if this is going to be a middle grade or a young adult book, but there's one. So Mateus is, Azorean and Portuguese, and I have been back to Lisbon a couple of times, once as part of the Zank Writers Conference, Zank Books, and I just loved it. And I'm fascinated by the dictatorship there, and I would love to go back and write a book to do with that. And there's something brewing about that, but I don't know what it is. I'm just gonna have to wait till that narrator fully forms and shows up with the story, but I can feel that that's something coming in. Yeah.
You know, Portugal is someplace that I've been wanting to go. I've been to most European countries and somehow I've missed that one. And I've thought of doing a river cruise on the Porto River. And I also have a friend who has gone to Portugal many times. Part of the Way of Santiago is in Portugal. And she was actually a guide on that. And so that sounds really fascinating too.
That's just such a rich area. And whenever I'm there, I can almost feel, Morocco across the water down there. Yeah, I just
Oh,
love it. I love it down there. And
yeah.
especially Lisbon and, the old city there. It's so beautiful. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And yeah, it's worth seeing.
Well, that would have been someplace I may have gone this year if. But now we'll see how long it'll be. So, well, Heather, we're about out of time, but do you have some words of advice for people who want to write fiction?
I do, actually. It's everybody approaches writing differently, and everybody has the you have to figure out what works for you. There's no one thing. But I would say that the number one thing that has been my lesson throughout it all is to learn patience with not only yourself, but with the story in the process, and to really listen to what the story wants to be about and what the characters need to have happen in the story. And that's a hard place to get to, I think, where you can step back and let those things happen. And then, as Pete Fromm told me, stay with the scene.
Ah.
I can see on the page now when writers aren't doing that. And I'm like, oh, they're writing around that. Oh, they're not very clear. Very vague.
And do you ever find yourself still doing that?
Oh, sure. And you can hedge it, and I'll hedge it and not even realize it. And I'll think, gosh, this story isn't working. This story isn't working. And then I'll go back and, oh, okay. Yeah, I sidestepped that. There.
Yep, you gotta write about the parts that you don't want to write.
Exactly.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for being with us today. You know, Mom usually has a closing quote for us, so I looked up a quote on Colorado. And this is from John Hickenlooper, who of course was a businessman and politician in Colorado. He said, "Colorado has always been a good place to find what you're made of."
Oh, I would agree. Yeah. Come visit us.
I would love to, and I may just do that.
Okay.
Thank you for being here, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you, Monica. Bye-bye.
Bye.